provided by Uber Conference.
Greetings, greetings. Welcome, welcome, welcome to another episode of Real Life, the radio show. I am your host, Jenna Capra, alongside my co-host, Brother Roz. Today is April the 9th, 2019. And yesterday was a special event for me, even though I did not participate. We had a full-length interview of my man, Roz. Brother Roz, first and foremost, how are you doing today, and how did that whole situation come about?
All right. Peace and love to you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you great.
All right, cool, because I had myself muted multiple times, so I was like, I don't know if I got all the mutes off. But, yeah, peace and love to you. Greetings and good evening to all the callers and listeners. I see Brother Cujo in the house. Peace to you, too. Before we get started, I just wanted to just implore everyone to please support Black Talk Radio Network by donating. You can actually do so at blacktalkradionetwork.com. Also, you can also help us with your financial energy by subscribing to BTR Community. At BTR Community, it is a closed social media space where you can have conversations with like-minded Black people without the prospect of being data mined or having your information sold or having yourself potentially be exposed if some company decides to look up your social media history. And it costs about $24 a year, which will translate to $2 a month or 50 cents per week. In order to join the community, and you'll be able to communicate with myself and other radio show hosts, as well as other Black African descendant individuals around the globe who are basically working towards helping us solve problems collectively as a group and moving into a position of setting up a system of justice. So please support the network and help us to continue to bring the content to you and do what we do and what we love to do. So with that being said, I just want to make sure I, you know, do that first and give a shout out to Scotty Reed, the founder of Black Talk Radio Network. So with that, how everything came to be was I was actually listening to a program with Lance Skurr. Lance Skurr is like one of my favorite radio personalities. He really, and he's way more than that. He's an activist, he's a cartoonist. He does a lot of work in the community. And he's been doing it since like 2001. So it's not something that's brand new at all. And he had a show. So it was a really, really good show. And I posted it on BTR Community. So Scotty chimed in and he said, yo, this was a good conversation. It would be great to have Lance on the network. I said, I've been thinking like that for a little while now. I said, let me try and reach out to him because he makes himself pretty accessible. So normally for me, when I listen to other people on the radio, I'll lay in the cut for a long time and not say anything. And I'll just listen to what everybody else has to say, kind of get a feel for how things run on the program, just the different thoughts and ideas of the people who call in. So I'll just listen for a long time and never say anything. And that's pretty much what I did with Lance's show. They had the chat room. I never jumped in the chat room. I'll just listen and pretty much save them because there's such a lot of great information there. So this particular show, Scotty chimed in on, and I said, cool, let me reach out. So I reached out to him. I reached out to him actually in the chat room first. And then when I did so, I said, you know, I talked to him about, you know, about him joining the network and saying, hey, you know, we would love to have you over there. It's a platform that's independent and is Black run and Black owned by us and for us. So because he's been saying this for many shows that we need our own platforms. You know, he hates having to deal with YouTube. because a lot of the stuff that they, a lot of things he has to do, ways he has to censor himself to get around their nonsense, and then sometimes they mess with his stuff. So when I broke it down to him, he gave us a shout out like right there in the chat immediately. He said, "Yo, I'll talk to you." So the first time I reached out to him, I didn't get through to him, and I didn't know it. But 2 weeks later is when I took the second attempt, and that's when I talked to him. So we built for a while, and he was really, really interested. Eventually, I got him in touch with Spotty. He ended up like immediately setting up his account and everything. But he does like mad shows in a day. He might do 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 shows in a day, or he'll do a 6-hour show and then jump on like 10 minutes later and do another one. That's just how he does his thing. So, we had had a conversation very early when I first reached out to him, and he was like, "Yo, this conversation is radio worthy. Like, we gotta do this on the air." So I was like, "Yeah, we'll do it." You know, I was like, "Cool, we'll do it one day." I didn't really think anything of it, but I was down. So, the second time we talked, he was like, it was his birthday was yesterday. So I hit him up and we started another conversation, and the conversation got so deep that he ended up going out, coming back later, and then we ended up talking to each other again. The conversation got real deep again, and he was taking his wife to work. So I ended up talking to him and his wife, and she's a wonderful, intelligent Jamaican woman. Like, she's she is so on point with her warrior spirit. It's ridiculous. So we had this conversation. She was completely blown away with the stuff that I was talking to her about. I was talking about pretty much comparing blacks in America to the Holocaust based on certain signs that I've seen in the way that our country's progressing, that we're they're trying to take us into some either concentration camp or slavery type of scenario. And I broke down why I felt that way. And she was completely blown away. And she was like, "I agree." So, that night, he was like, "Yo, it's my birthday, so, you know, can you do me the solid and just do the show?" I said, "I don't mind." I said, "It's fine, no problem." And at first, we were planning to do it another day, but I was just like, "Yo, I got the time. Let me just do it and just bang it out." And I said, "It's his birthday. Cool. It'll be my birthday present to him that we just get to, you know, really build and get this stuff out." So I hop on, and I only expected to be on the air maybe 2 hours, 3 at the most. Everything progressed, and I was just going through all the different topics that I noticed for myself that I wanted to touch on. And as the conversation progressed, and at times Lance would chime in or ask me questions or make comments, and we would just expand on certain topics. So it ran for like over 6.5 hours, and I was just blown away. Just by the length of time, because it was unexpected, but it was fine because I actually enjoyed every minute of it. And I think that there was just a lot of good things that were brought out in that discussion that a lot of people have never heard before, maybe never heard it presented that way. There's a lot that a lot of people never heard before, I'm sure of that. But there was a lot of other things that if they did hear about it before, it wasn't presented to them in the way that I decided to present it last night. So that's just how that whole thing developed. And I kind of developed a reputation in his chat room because a couple of people who listen to us on our platform or also listen on his. And on a few occasions, I was tapped for information in the chat room, and people kind of flocked to what we were discussing when we had these discussions in the chat room, or when I would drop the information that they were requesting in the chat room. So I kind of had a reputation already, but none of them ever really heard me talk if they don't listen to us here. So that was their first chance to hear me. And from what Lance was saying, the response was overwhelming, to say the least. As far as like after the show, you could see the whole chat room was just a buzz. There was probably 269 people at last that I saw that were in the chat throughout the whole
this
program.
Call is being recorded.
So it was just an interesting experience, especially to be live and to see all these people. And when I got to go back and go through the chat room again and kind of check it out, it was nuts. Because you had people from everywhere. There was a few Trinidadians there, had me laughing. I was like, "Wow, okay." And you had some folks from the continent. It was people from all over. And I was just like, "Whoa." And I was like, just kind of shocked, because during the program, I really didn't get to go to the chat that much. I did a couple of times and talked to a couple of people briefly. But it was just a great experience, man. I mean, to just say that, it was just awesome to kind of freestyle it and be able to just touch on a myriad of topics that I felt especially for this new audience, because people who listen to us, they know how we get down already. But for other people who I knew, the majority never heard me speak before. They saw me in the chat, but they never really got to hear me in my own words discuss things that I feel Black people need to know about. And I got that chance on his platform, and they were able to hear who they saw chatting. So I think for a lot of them, that was cool too. So I don't know. I could be incorrect, but I thought it was a great experience for me. It really was. And to reach all those people was just a wonderful thing, to have just Black people really are interested and in a lot of ways and in their own ways working towards flipping the system, you know, really, really flipping the system. And Lance has a lot of strong supporters who, because like I said, he does a lot of community work where he is in Florida. So they support him, whether it's with their financial energy, with people just showing up, people volunteering, and people reach out to him from all over the world. So I think he has an extremely active African-centered community. And what I saw there with him that I really liked was that even the Aboriginal people who were there were not BS Aboriginal people. These were people who actually had their tribal names. They spoke in their tribal language, and sometimes they would actually put stuff in the chat and just say, let us know what certain phrases meant, because that's just how they respond in their culture. And some of them have a deep history here. Two in particular that really, really stood out, because they just really exposed a lot of who they were. They were older brothers too, like in their early 50s, both of them. But they were just on point, and I really respected them. And they never said that they were an African. They just said, hey, I'm indigenous to America. This is my culture. America is my home, Turtle Island, as they call it. And it was just great to see conscious. And when I say conscious, I mean literally people who are in a non-unconscious state, who are Aboriginal heritage, who understand their place in the world space as descendants of African people who are from the Americas. So it was just beautiful to experience that in such a holistic way after some of the stuff that we have been through before. So like I said, it was really great, because there was a lot of different learning experiences I had, and then it just really felt good to unload and give, like you called it, Jenna, a kind of synopsis of some of the main topics we've discussed over the years that I felt that his audience should get exposed to via me, since they were being introduced to me for the first time. So that's it. I hope I wasn't too long-winded.
No, I don't even think you would like to do that no more after last night. But I could tell when it first jumped off, it's like, yeah, Jenna ain't up here to try to cut me down, make sure I don't talk too much. If anybody,
I was conscientious of that.
Yeah, if anybody ever thought that you couldn't, it was proven that you could. Just rapid flow information, one after another. It was amazing to just watch the people in the chat create their own conversations based off of people just hearing bits and pieces of information that if they disagree or if they agree or however it touched them, that they can go and check for themselves. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed it. It was one sister in particular, and you had pointed this out to me, and I went back to look, and she was shouting out her son. Well, excuse me, you shouted out her son, because her son, 6 years old, was sitting there listening with his jaw dropped, all attention being paid to Roz. So that's one of the questions that I have. One of the questions that I have to begin with is, how does that feel? Like we know that this information is being passed just from the data that that brother Scotty passes on to us by way of the back end. But to hear the sister tell you that while you're doing, I call it a lecture, while you was doing your lecture, how does that feel?
I'm going to tell you something, because I'm glad you brought that up, because that to me was one of the biggest honors and one of the most profound experiences when I actually saw that the sister reached out and told me that. And I was like, and I gave her son a shout out because I wanted him to know, like, I know you're there. It kind of reminded me because, like I said, I started sitting at the feet of our previous generation of giants when I was 5, 6 years old. So when I look back to how I felt at that age, and Dr. Bang was young, so he was like a straight firebrand, and he didn't bite his tongue and say exactly what he had to say. Like, that's just the kind of dude he was. And and I remember the impact it had on me because of what he was saying and how he was saying it. So to know that I had a similar impact on another young Black male, and his mom thought what I was saying was so important that she had her 6-year-old sit right next to me. And once he started hearing it, he, like me, gravitated towards the message. That blew my mind because it kind of reminds me of some of the conversations I've had with your children and the way that they respond. And because they're very brilliant, insightful, thinking young human beings. And I don't normally think that I'm able to reach young people because of the fact that sometimes I can use big words or I might speak about concepts that I think they might not grasp. But what I've come to understand over the years is that each generation is more advanced as far as their ability to understand the world that we're in at a younger age. It doesn't mean that there aren't limits to what they should have access to as far as knowing and understanding, just for their own safety and the proper upbringing of a young human being, Black human being. But I do understand that they understand concepts that if you can just make them as simple as you can. And I wasn't making them simple. That's the funny part. I did use some big words at the time. I didn't use a lot of them, thankfully. I understood that I may be reaching an audience that may not resonate with all of that or understand. So I tried to keep the word accessible to them as far as maybe their ability to understand the words. But I did use a couple of big words. And he was still able to sit, understand, and he was mesmerized with the conversation from what I got from his mom. And it was a beautiful thing. It was one of the most honorable things or experiences I could say I've had. And big up to Sister Ajua too, because she's been she's been shouting me out every time she sees me in the chat, and she's been listening to us for a long time. Actually, her and I go back to I believe Beverly D. So that's like the very beginning of my radio experience. So she was making some powerful comments too in the chat, but she always is there, and she had a big presence in the chat room yesterday too. So I wanted to give her a shout. And the mother of the young child, I remember her name was Danielle, so I'll just call her Sister Danielle. I can't remember her last name, but shout out to you all too, and especially if y'all are on the line tonight. Peace and love to you and your son. But yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. Because once you did, it just triggered that flood, because I remember it was one of the most impactful parts of the whole night.
Yeah, I thought it was dope, man. Like I said, I was enjoying just sitting back and watching the conversations that was developing as the conversation went on. Now, I was there more for that, just to see what people was going to say, wondering if there were going to be trolls, just things of that nature. It wasn't as much as I thought, but the ones that were there were very significant as far as pulling people into those type of conversations. And over the course of tonight, I'm gonna be dipping in back and forth, asking you questions about that. I guess we would call this a post interview. Because it was something that I have never, it's been a long time since I seen somebody speak in that manner for that long and actually deliver some substance. And it's not that I didn't know you could do it or that I didn't expect you to do it. It was more of me watching the people absorb it. And so I'm going to be jumping back and forth with that. But what I want to jump off of this subject and go on to is something that's been going on, and we have talked about this for a few years now, And that's the constant beat down from one another. Now, I'm not going to get too deep into this because, brother, shout out to Brother Scotty. Scotty's going to do something on this, but we was talking about Nipsey Hussle. Well, you gave him a rest in peace, which I'm going to give him one as well. I didn't say nothing last week. I just let you finish that. But, yes, and rest in peace to all of the people that have got gunned down all over the country in general, whoever they may be, not just Nipsey Hussle. But it's a lot of people get upset when people don't talk about what's going on in their own neighborhoods. And that's a conversation that I want to get on to also. And I could be wrong in my viewpoint of why people don't do it as much as we should. But before we get to that, I wanted to get onto this Kodak Black thing, right? And I'm not going to get too deep into that. But Scotty had pointed out that the hypocrisy of the game and of T.I. And it's something that I had noticed too, because these are some of the elements that they use to rise up in the rap game, talking about people's killing people and being with their significant other and all of this type of stuff. And because it's Nipsey and it's their friend, all of a sudden it's they're not having it now. And I'm not saying that it's right that he's doing that, but I'm like, at what point have any of those two gentlemen or anybody else that's criticizing him for that, when did they take their steps to apologize for saying that same thing to whoever they was talking about back in the day when I was coming up?
And did you hear, just to interject briefly, did you hear about the game getting sued and losing over $7 million, I think it's $7.9 million to a female that he basically overstepped his bounds with?
I mean, which time,
it just
though?
Happened like a few weeks ago. So okay, he literally lost like $7.9 million in a lawsuit. She sued him and won because he had touched her inappropriately without her permission or something like that. So, I mean, this is a guy who has issues with females himself. And I'm not saying what Kodak Black did is correct, but you're absolutely right. I mean, both of them have been disrespectful to other males and their females. Both of them have put out the same type of music, you know, drug dealer killer music, Rubber Man, Wild Like the Taliban. I mean, it's real talk.
Yeah, so one of my favorite joints too, by the way. I ain't gonna front.
Yeah, but it's just, the thing is that the you can see literally, and I'm taking a step back, because Dr. Wilson used to say that certain aspects of rap music could be considered a mental illness. And she used to talk about the way certain rappers use their words, that she would literally, as a psychiatrist, say that the way that they're doing what they do, especially with the antisocial, anti-black music.
Hold on, Ross. Now, Brother Scott is going to go in on this subject pretty in-depth, so I want to leave some of that for them. The question that I had specifically, though, the reason why I brought that up is I was thinking about I was thinking and brainstorming about some of the past ways we have been tricked or as you would say, coalesced into doing something detrimental, right? And then I was, and while all of these images and passages, the different books, conversations between me and you, all of this stuff going through my head briefly, you know, just searching for something to pick at. And I was talking to you earlier and I said that no tragedy will go wasted or something along those lines. Now,
good tragedy should go to waste.
Is this a way to promote violence upon each other, the way they just covering this media, the way the media is covering this, kind of just blowing it up more than it should? This man haven't even been buried yet still, and that's getting more coverage than what's going on with the family. You know, I just see how all of these different, speaking of distractions, all of these things come about, and I'm just wondering what would be your take on that particular part.
I would say this, one thing that really, really scares the system of white supremacy is when gangbangers, black gangbangers, come together. We saw it happen in, with L.A. when the L.A. gangs first had their truce, and it was beautiful. They were having barbecues. You had guys that in the previous week were literally trying to do drive-bys on each other that were just hugging, and it was just everything was cool with large swaths of the gangs, but it wasn't all of them. And the LAPD was found out to have stolen gang members' actual vehicles, dressed up as gangbangers, and then fired shots at their previous enemies that they had a truce with, causing everything that they built to collapse. And, you know, we know that the gang violence got bigger and continued until now. And with Nipsey's death, his death alone has facilitated the same thing all over again. So they know that the black military is the gang. The black police force is the gang, because when you study their history, that's what they were. They were actually civic organizations that started to protect black people from white savages at first in LA when they were trying to go to school. They would get jumped every day by white gangs, so they had to actually band together to start whipping those white boys behind in order to get to school. And they would name themselves after the block they were from. So it would be for example, and it's not a real game, but the Sloths and Crips, or, you know, the Mob Tyru. It's all about the block you were from, and then y'all just roll together as a clique, and any white boys would try to jump you, you would be able to defend yourself. Then what happened was white flight. The white people left because they got tired of being around black people, and once they left, black people had nobody else to fight, so they turned in on themselves. That's how the whole gang thing happened in the first place. So they were actually community organizations that were meant to do something positive. And when you see the gangs for white people, when they see those gangs go from killing each other to coming together, they know the next logical step is point your weapons in the right direction. Because really, when you talk about gangers, that's what I mean when I say, like, they are our militia. Because there's some people in the society that are meant to be warriors. Not everybody's meant to have a cushy job in the office, or, you know, to be a construction worker, or to have a trade. Some people are born into this life and they are warriors. They are meant to be people who, if stuff hits the fan, they are able to hunt other people. That's just a fact. And for us, culturally, those have been our folks. They have just been self-destructive. So to me, to set this thing off on Kodak Black, sets the precedent for, again, black on black violence. Then if something happens to Kodak Black because some LA gang member gets pissed, comes over here and guns him down, that creates beef then between, let's say, ATL and LA. So it's really, to me, you're going to see some way of them trying to facilitate agitation between black factions all over again, because they can't have the guys who have the goons and are willing to use them coming together. Because, like I said, the next logical step is, why are we pointing guns at each other when we know the real orchestrators of our misery, and they're the ones who should be getting the bullet? I could be incorrect, but that just seems to be the pattern with the system. Once you go back and see, when you look at what Tupac did as far as bringing the gangs together, he had the Code of Thug Life, him and Tupac Shakur wrote together, and he facilitated getting that out to the gangbangers. He met with gang leaders, started bringing people together. He's dead. when he died, there were dozens of people who were killed. The gang wars kicked off immediately when Pop was killed. So this is what it's about. It's really about, and I keep telling black people, when white people, whatever white people don't want you to do is exactly what you should be doing. And what they have done is that they don't want us coming together under any circumstances. So that's exactly what we should be doing. Because when you look at the history, they came together to dominate the planet. We have to come together to cease their dominance of us and the planet. It's only logical. But the only people who don't see that is us.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're working on that. I appreciate that. Same thing I was looking at, but you said it so much more eloquently. Yeah. To get back to the post interview, though. there was a few more things that you had hit on. And, well, before we do that, you are listening to Real Life, the radio show. And if you have a question or comment, by all means, give us a call. That number is 719-284-5271. That number again is 719-284-5271. And the PIN is 70637.
No point.
But
I do not remember it for the life of me yet. Go ahead.
I'm trying to figure if you do have a question or comment. I guess is it push star 4 on here on this one, Roz?
To open up their mic. Star star.
Okay.
It might be star star or star 6-1. It's either one of the two. I just don't know which one yet because it's a new number. But it's either star star or star 6-1.
All right, but anyhow, sure. we'll make it work. I may even just open them up and see if anybody have a question.
Okay.
But getting back to this post interview, there were a few more questions that I had, starting with the preparedness. Now, we've talked about that, getting with Dave, having and I've learned a lot over the years in a lot of ways of how to save and store that stuff too. Brother and Sister Davis, all of them have contributed greatly to the knowledge that I have now about what I need to look for, buy, and how to store it. Why was that one of the things that you wanted to share with the people? Because I know this audience that you was listening to, that was listening to you, most of them had never heard of you or heard from you before. So why was that one of the more important things you wanted to get out, this being the first time you any of these people ever heard from you?
Well, I would say this. I really wanted to discuss things that I don't remember hearing in recent history on Lance Gerv. And that was one of those things that I don't remember anyone talking about specifically. I mean, some people have brought it up in conversations that have been quite vehement in trying to help them like understand that things are about to get ugly in a way that no one has ever experienced before. And Black people are going to be the most acutely affected by these changes that are coming. But I don't think anyone addressed it in the way that I addressed it. And the reason why I addressed it in that way was because I wanted to help them understand that this is like literally right around the corner, that there's certain things you want to know in order to understand how best to prepare for what's coming. And I know that I haven't heard anyone talk about a lot about silver and gold acquisition, what is an asset, the reasons why that's important. No one really has talked about Venezuela on a level, except for Renita Jones, but I wanted to tackle it from a standpoint to help them understand how money functions and why gold and silver is important, and using Venezuela as the context, because I want, like I said on the show, it's coming here. It's coming here. I told them, and that's why I gave them that scenario. Imagine you buy a pack of double mint. You know, you eat that pack of gum, you wake up the next day, and you go to buy the same pack of gum, and it was $1 yesterday, but it's $500 today. And I'm like, that's really what's going to happen here. And I said, you got a bunch of Black people with guns, registered and unregistered, who are going to go from, like, and I said, just like Dave said, from civil to civilized to feral instantly. You're not going to be able to tell me that a person wakes up to not being able to go to the bank to get money because there's a bank run and they say it's a bank holiday or something, or austerity measures, we close in the bank. So everybody's outside. It'll be just like 1929, because I remember seeing the old video footage. You had thousands of people outside of bank just banging on the door, banging, banging, banging. And the bank workers were just walking around like they weren't even there. Then they had people jumping off of buildings because there were millionaires the day before. And the next day they had absolutely nothing. And these were people who were probably the worst kind of human beings, that were so high, living so high on the hog, probably abusive and mistreating people because they had money. They couldn't even fathom what it would be like. How would they survive not having any money anymore? So a lot of folks committed suicide. And I'm like, that's what's going to happen here. you're going to have a bunch of people hungry as heck because, you know, 99% of the United States lives paycheck to paycheck, period. You finishing the previous debt, so you might have a couple dollars in your wallet, but that bank account is dead. And then when you go to the store, they ask you for 500% more than what you were used to paying for something. You telling me that they're not going to grab the nominal meat and say, I'm getting busy to get some food? You got to be kidding me. You better not be walking around chewing a hamburger from McDonald's. Somebody might blow your head off and take it. That's what it's going to be like. And I wanted them to understand with extreme intensity the importance of how close this is and the fact that the United States is responsible. It has been documented in the records that the United States is responsible for the three previous blackouts in Venezuela. In Caracas, Venezuela, they left those people without running water. They was drinking sewage water and because their toilets didn't work. Nothing was working for weeks. And they're backed by the two most powerful countries on the planet, Russia and China. And they also have some of the world's greatest hackers. So you telling me that they're not going to repay the favor and hack into our grid and do the same thing to us, and it's not going to be for a couple of weeks? You think they're going to care about the citizens? If you got elderly relatives that's on an oxygen machine and it has to be plugged in, they're dead. If you have any relatives that are taking regular prescription pills, they're not going to be delivered. If you have a sickly child and they might need some asthma medicine, even though you shouldn't be giving that to them, but let's say you're one of those parents, which the vast majority of Black people are those parents, they're not getting their asthma medicine. What you going to do about that?
Man,
everybody got a gun.
It's survival
and everybody
mode.
Got Black rage. You understand what I'm saying? And you think them white folks who legally own arsenals, we've talked about that on the news. Dudes with 500 super automatic weapons, HMKs and AK-47s and, you know, AR-13s and AR-15s and all of that stuff. You got one guy owning like thousands of weapons with grenades in their house and their garage and all kind of stuff. And you mean to tell me that they're not going to be gunning down Black people and having a safari fund at our expense?
Man, it's already. This has already been proven. I mean, you know, Katrina.
Yeah, so I'm saying America, Black folks, I wanted to implore them to say, listen, I'm not trying to scare you, but I want you to understand what preparedness looks like. Understand what's the difference between currency and money. Understand that you're giving your boss the priceless, your time, your energy, and your attention. All things you will never get back, but worthless, a debt note. I wanted them to really understand that and that how to transfer that debt note into something that is not debt, but an asset. Yeah. And I just felt that that was one of the most important parts of the discussion, just because I know that they haven't heard it and they didn't hear it from that perspective. Because I actually had the same conversation with Lance's wife when he was driving her to work. And she told me, you need to say this stuff on the air right here. So that was one of the driving forces of me talking about it was when I talked to her about it. It had such a profound impact on her because she knows what's coming and has known for a while and in her own way has talked about it. And she used Jamaica as the example. So when I said it in that way to her, she had never heard anyone explain it the way I did. And once I did, she said, oh, the audience needs to hear this. And she was like, I'll be calling in for work. I'm going to check out the program. And, you know, she was just ecstatic. And I was like, cool. I said, I feel good about that. So right there, I was like, okay, I know for a fact I need to add this to the discussion. It was already on my mind. But once I talked to her, that there's no question that that's the direction I was going from that point forward.
Okay. Well, I want to, I'm going to transition real quick off of that because of this, cool. This inflation and stuff that you're talking about. With the talk of reparations being so ongoing, there's other people trying to get money up out of the United States too. So let me play this video right here real quick. Just to stay up. Now this is John Bolton, National Security Advisor.
Today, on the eve of September the 11th, I want to deliver a clear and unambiguous message on behalf of the President of the United States. The United States will use any means necessary to protect our citizens and those of our allies from unjust prosecution by this illegitimate court. We will not cooperate with the ICC. We will provide no assistance to the ICC, and we certainly will not join the ICC. We will let the ICC die on its own. After all, for all intents and purposes, the ICC is already dead to us. The United States bases this policy on five principal concerns about the court, its purported authority, and its effectiveness. First, the International Criminal Court unacceptably threatens American sovereignty and U.S. national security interests. The prosecutor in The Hague claims essentially unfettered discretion to investigate, charge, and prosecute individuals, regardless of whether their countries have acceded to the Rome Statute. The court in no way derives these powers from any grant of consent by non-parties to the statute. Instead, the ICC is an unprecedented effort to vest power in a supranational body without the consent of either nation states or the individuals over which it purports to exert jurisdiction. It certainly has no consent whatever from the United States.
For those of you that probably don't know what he's talking about,
Energizer is now a Guinness World Records holder.
That was he was talking about the International Criminal Court and the prosecutor that he was speaking of. Now, maybe you can say this name correctly. Fatmu Binswa. It's a now let's see who she is real quick.
You have that in the thread?
No, I didn't put that in the thread. That was something that you just sparked my memory when you was talking about the inflation and stuff.
Well, it's interesting because what they're saying is pretty much, even though the U.S. is in receivership, they're not going to cooperate or comply with anything that the UN's International Criminal Court does to try and prosecute individual politicians for the behavior of the U.S. government via the U.S. military around the world. And what they're saying is America is only a part of the United Nations as long as it gets to dominate and tell the United Nations what to do. Once the United Nations decides to side with the rest of the planet in regards to dealing with the way the United States exercises its hegemony and tyranny, then all of a sudden, your governing body isn't good enough, blah, 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 and all of the stuff that they're saying. Now, I said this about the reparation situation last night, too. You, and I might have said it to Lance off air. I don't know if I said it on air. You might remember, because like you said, like I said, it was over 6 hours of conversation, so I don't know. And I talked for a long time to Lance prior and a long time on the air, so I don't know which one, but I know I said it yesterday. I broke down first that as of 2013, a dollar was only worth 4 cents. In 1913, a dollar was actually worth a dollar. And that in 1919, $1 million was worth $1 million. And in 2013, $1 million was worth $42,000 and change. So the value of a dollar has dropped so dramatically. So, and we're now in 2019. So you know that it's a lot lower than that with all of the different machinations of the stock market that have been taking place, the housing market, the college debt, all of that. It's plummeted probably. It's probably less. $1 is probably worth much less than a dollar, but we're just not feeling that yet as far as our exchange of money when we go to the stores. And I said, right now, the hashtag ADOS people are adamant about getting some form of monetary compensation, whether it's to start programs or whether it's for individual families being paid out, whatever. But I'm like, they're giving you money that's so crappy in value that it's laughable. So let's say they do give them reparations. They give them a few billion dollars. Let's say $3 billion, like they did for the Northern Australians, right? That $3 billion isn't worth anything. They're going to collapse the economy, and then every bit of that $3 billion you got is going to be worth absolutely nothing. And then you're going to say, well, you didn't give me an asset. I want an asset that's worth something so that we can actually be repaired for this damage. And they're going to say, nope, we already gave you the reparations that you asked for. And it's not worth anything, but you can't do anything about it. That I could see them doing something like that. I really could. And that's why I said that they should be asking for assets instead of dollars. And there's a whole bunch of things that go into the approach on how to solve this problem, because they can literally pull a fast one on you and give you your reparations and screw you at the same time if they want to. And this government is highly capable of that, because that's what it's done throughout its entire history. And that was, to me, a big part of that whole policy of looking at the ICC as anything to really kowtow to and be controlled by, really says that China, Russia, the BRICS nations, all the people who have turned against the United States and eventually are going to be invading its shores, they're going to have to beat this dragon savagely in order to bring it to heel. And once they do, it's going to be game over, in a way that none of us are prepared for, because we're going to be trapped in the border while the country's actually being attacked by those people. Because what he's saying is, you guys are going to have to really kick our behind before we do anything. And that's what's going to happen. So I don't think even most people understand that in that short clip that you just played.
Yeah, he said, if you want it, you're going to have to take it.
Kill us, or you're going to have to take over this bad boy so bad, which means they're going to have to bomb this bad boy. They're going to have to invade with soldiers or with killer Terminator robots, because now we're all in that realm. They're going to have to EMP us or hack the grid and shut it down and say, well, unless you kowtow to the ICC, we're not going to turn on the light. Like, this is what he's saying to them.
Yeah.
After America already did the same thing to Venezuela, so the gloves are off now. Anything goes now. And I live in the Northeast. This area is ripe for that, because all of the most important things are centered here. The financial heartbeat of the planet and the nation is in New York City. The capital of the entire country is a couple hundred miles away, or 100 and some odd plus a couple hundred miles away in D.C. So we all clustered in the same area. So if they shut off the grid here, the most important aspects of American society that keeps everything running on a daily basis is over. I literally said I live in the most dangerous part of the United States to reside in when everything hits the fan, because this is where all of these important things are. That's why 9/11, that's why they ran the planes into the World Trade Center. Well, New York City, if it wasn't for that, New York City wouldn't be as important as it is, but it is. So yeah, go ahead.
But that's what it's about. She's a prosecutor, and she's investigating war crimes in Afghanistan based off of the claim from off the war that happened because of 9/11. So it's, man, it's a lot going on. I'm not even sure if people knew that was going on. But
that's what I was thinking about, was what if you get reparations and then they immediately collapse with the economy? What does that money mean? What programs can you start? When they tell you, we don't want that crap you call a U.S. dollar, we need assets. And the government's going to tell you, go screw yourself, you got your reparations.
Oh yeah, that's one aspect of it. It's quite a few
scenario. You're absolutely right. Go ahead.
That's for another show though. We'll get to that on another day, because I don't think we got enough time for that today.
Yep, you're right.
But
was there any other questions you had?
For the show last night, no. No
okay,
more.
Cool.
I wanted to go back to I wanted to go back to this Nipsey Hussle thing.
Okay.
And thinking it, going back to thinking about no good disaster goes to waste. I am in the belief that the government has, to me, I guess, would be all different scenarios playing out for how they can manipulate us. And whether or not this murder was a conspiracy with all of the different information that's flowing, I am under the impression that they would use this confusion of whether it was the government, whether it wasn't, inside job, or what have you. I am under the impression that they would use that confusion to mistreat us. And a couple of different things popped up in my head. But before I go into that, is that a viable question, or am I crazy?
Okay. You mean as far as questioning his death or the reasons for his death?
Well, taking that out, just the confusion that causes, I think they're going to start manipulating that. Maybe placing things here and there for people to follow just to create more confusion. That's what I mean.
Oh, yeah. I agree with that, because remember, this is warfare being waged on us. We're not at war with people, unless you're talking about being at war with each other. But outside of that context, we're not at war. They're at war with us.
Right.
And any real tech that deals with military strategy will tell you that war is based on deception. Whether it's the Art of War, the Book of the Five Rings, the 48 Laws of Power, Mastering the Art of War, any of those texts, they're going to tell you that warfare is deception. And this country mastered the art of deception. That is why a lot of the most important world events surrounding white supremacy started here and spread everywhere else. Eugenics started here. Germany got wind of it. They used it against the Jews. Creation of white people, 1681, started here. Now the whole planet understands what it means to be white. So America is the foundational vector of all of the diseases of white supremacy we see as they play out around the world. America is the manufacturing center of the most valuable export to come out of Europe, which are the most high-level white supremacist psychopaths on the planet. And they have taught and infected all the other white people, and those other white people have infected all of the non-white people along with them to create this world that we live in today. So for a lot of the problems that the world has had, the world has today to exist, it's because America exists.
All right, three.
If America didn't exist, none of this stuff would be a reality, because they got it all from over here. So to me, it's very telling that we're going into a situation where the economy is going to collapse. It's really going to be all about here, because I think a big part of us conquering white supremacy is the destruction of the untied states of America. In whatever way that it happens, it just has to happen. But we have to be prepared, because historically, the people who are most acutely affected by what affects this country is us. And that, you know, ties into the conversation we had yesterday, and it ties into the conversation we have tonight. So, yeah. I mean, think about that. A lot of the things that we look at as the worst forms of treatment of human life on the planet, those concepts were created and cultivated, incubated here. And other white supremacists saw the success of the programs America created and the ideology surrounding the creation of whiteness in 1681. They took the baton and ran with it. So it says a lot to me. It really, really says a lot. England didn't come up with it. Germany didn't come up with it. You know, Russia didn't come up with it. It happened here. And who started this country? British people. All of the Europeans are German. I don't care what part of the Europe they come from. The foundational stock of European people are German. And they had three ethnic groups there, the Anglos, the Saxons, and the Jutes. And those three groups went to all the other places that we call countries today and settled those countries and became the people we know them to be today. But genetically, they're the same stock. That's one of the reasons Dr. Welsen used to call them an inbred race.
Yeah.
So it's real.
Speaking.
It's really real. Go ahead.
Speaking of Dr. Welsen, I had this little snippet and I wanted to get your take on this also.
All right, three historical churches in the same Louisiana parish have burned in 10 days. All of them have a large African-American congregation, and now the state's fire marshal is calling it suspicious. CNN's Kaylee Hartung is here with the latest on this. So no one has been hurt in these fires, but authorities feel like this is no coincidence.
That's right, Fred. And all three of these fires burned in the middle of the night. So thankfully, no one was hurt. But the similarities go beyond the timing of these three fires that have happened in the last 10 days. All three of these churches have been very active in the St. Landry Parish community for more than 100 years. And all three of these buildings were located on or near rural highways in the area. Now, authorities haven't yet said that they can conclusively connect these three fires, but the state fire marshal did say that all three fires are suspicious, saying they've identified, quote, suspicious elements in each of these cases, and he says those elements are being thoroughly probed. The fire marshal cautions that arson investigations can take months. These are incredibly complicated situations to walk into because it's a scenario in which all of your evidence has been burned. All three of these churches have been reduced to not much more than rubble. So this investigation is going to take a lot of time, and these investigators have a lot of work ahead of them, Fred. But the St. Landry Parish Sheriff says some progress has been made, and he says he hears the community's pleas to find out who's responsible for this.
Right. And of course, you know, there are multiple agencies involved. And while you talk about the, you know, these structures being really decimated, it's extraordinary the kind of firefighting investigation, you know, that can really zero in sometimes on accelerants.
Yeah, that's right. And to the question of motive, which of course is being discussed, there is a recognition that all three of these were African-American churches in this community. But the pastors in particular here are saying they don't want to inject race into this conversation. Reverend Harry Richard, one of the pastors of one of these churches that has been burned to the ground, saying, you know, we don't know who's doing this or why, but he doesn't want to inflame, no pun intended, the tensions in this community at this time. Listen to the message he hopes to deliver to his community this weekend.
God's grace is undeserved merit. I know we don't deserve this, but he gives us something better than this, and that's undeserved grace. I thank God for grace.
He will be delivering a sermon tomorrow on Sunday at a temporary location for his congregation. Fred, authorities locally are saying they are allocating manpower. They are authorizing overtime for people to help work through this investigation to protect people as they go to church this Sunday and also to find out who's responsible.
And sadly, the spate of fires in historically black churches has happened historically in this country before, so these investigations have some precedence in which to sometimes use as a guidepost as they try to figure out who may be responsible for these. All right, thanks so much, Kaylee Hartung. Appreciate that. All right.
Right on time with the racism getting more overt day in and day out.
Yeah, I just talked about that.
And we're seemingly getting more friendly about it with the forgiving that he didn't forgive anybody, but he had a forgiving voice. And maybe because he was on TV and hot man being down in Louisiana, if you've never been there, it's a tight spot. So, but looks like we have a caller. Greetings, caller. What's your name? Where you calling from? And what's your question or comment?
Peace. It's Cujo from NYC.
Greetings.
Green Ross, Green Jenna. Good to hear everything about the interview, man. It was definitely a blessing. I haven't gotten a chance to listen to it. I'm going to take some time to build on that a little later on tonight. You know, but
you won't finish it tonight.
Okay. Okay.
You might get to a little bit if you stay up late enough, but I know you got to work.
Enough said. I mean, I think one of the points that you, I actually really think that's going to be mandatory is that we still, and I got to go back to actually a program that was held that where Francis Kurtz Welsing spoke about, as a black man, we need to somehow get together and actually speak about some of the fears that we have in dealing with racism, white supremacy, and addressing it as is. You know, because a lot of times, you know, we do as what we call back around the block, we just front. We hold the poles and act like we're tough and we're rough enough to deal with anything and any issue. But the reality is we're not ready for this. You know, and what you're talking about, Roz, is a very important aspect of it, is we're not ready for all out kind of combat. We're not ready for a disaster. We're not ready for anything, much less mentally dealing with these racist white supremacists on a daily basis, whether it be at work or at the supermarket, engaging with them in any format. We're not ready for that. You know, and I don't think there's ever be a point where we're really quite ready to really go at them. But I think we had to start some kind of like dialogue amongst each other where it could be something private, where dudes could sit around and go, yo, we got to do this. We need to do that. We need to organize and do this, because ultimately these conversations are so mandatory. I mean, you spoke, from what I understand, it for such a long time. And it seems like the ears of our people are so thirsty to hear that. You understand what I'm saying? Like, they need to hear this. So imagine now if we take things, a program like this, or like the conversation you had in that interview, and we try to multiply that amongst our community, it will really quench a lot of people's thirst. Because I'm telling you, my son goes to a dojo in Bed-Stuy. So every time we go to the dojo, a lot of sisters sit around. One or two brothers are there. I have to admit, very few brothers bring their children there, mainly the sisters. But me being the father in it, I'm bringing my son. But the sisters get into it, you know, and they have the conversations, the hard conversation. And I could tell, I'm like, wow, these sisters don't have this conversation that much. Not even the women are having the conversation that much. You feel me? So it's not just as black men. Our sisters need to have this conversation too, because they get caught up in the whole another aspect of it that's a little bit more, that's even more complicated. You know what I mean? Dealing with feminism and all these other things where they feel like they should be a part of. It gets complicated for them just as well. So there needs to be some kind of group organizing. I'm talking like for real, like to really sit down and constantly build. But it definitely is going to require a lot of what Nellie Fuller teaches. You know, and
now you see why over the last 2 years specifically there's been an intense misinformation, disinformation propaganda program to create dissension within us as a people, specifically in this country. That's where you saw the coming of this hashtag ADOS, and not all of them are dissension oriented, but a good portion of some of them are. Then you had the Aboriginal movement with its nonsense. You have the Hebrews with their stuff. You got the Moors with their stuff. You got it's just everybody got something. And in the last 2 years, you have seen the dissension in a way that it hasn't, where this has in history, but we've never had social media in history. We've never really fully understood the impact of social media. So you're seeing it in regards to how to disrupt an entire group of people so they don't organize, I believe. And I think that's the reason, because organization is what breeds preparedness. And if we're not able to organize around anything, because we have a bunch of different ideological tribalists who can't come together on a single issue because they're more with their tribe than with the issue that needs to be solved, then it just leaves us, you know, life for the picking. And that's what we're going to see. If we don't, you know, like you so eloquently stated, start to organize and have these conversations, these hard conversations, just like you said, it's such a necessity. And that's why I believe you see the uptick in dissension-oriented programming in the social media sphere and with YouTube and all these other things and all of these different. And some of these black folks are just straight agents, the way that they deal, the stuff that they say, some of the nonsense that they call truth. And then they just have a whole bunch of bandwagon riders who just sit there and really just prop them up as if there's some sort of leader with some sort of information that's been held from us for thousands of years, and it's just a bunch of garbage. So I just think that this stuff is happening the way it is specifically to create dissension so that we don't organize in the manner that you're speaking of. And until we're able to see that and react to it by doing the opposite and saying, okay, I may not agree with you because I'm a Hebrew, I'm a Aboriginal, or I'm a hashtag NUOS or whatever I am, I do agree with you that we have these specific problems that we need to coalesce around solving. Until we're able to do that, everything you said is completely true. We're going to be in major trouble. And like I said, we don't have time. We don't have time to sit around arguing about nonsense. This stuff, this catastrophic global event that's going to start here is literally any day now, as far as I'm concerned. I just go to bed thinking I can wake up tomorrow and things are not the same as it was and will never be the same again. I've been through 9/11, and that was one of my first experiences with something like that. You went to bed one way, and the day was, everything about life was what you were used to. I mean, it changed a lot, but I mean, it was what you were used to and it was dealable. So you wake up the next day and you had no rights and you just had the most invasive system where you had no rights whatsoever. There's cameras everywhere. You're being told what to do. It's just ridiculous. So I just see that coming. And a lot of us are so busy arguing on YouTube and screaming at each other and calling each other out of our names that we don't see the bigger picture at all. I could be incorrect.
I agree. Jenna, what you said, I wanted to chime in just a little bit on that with Nipsey Hussle, and may rest in peace or rest in power, so to speak. But the thing about that, there's another thing about it. It's definitely that information that's going to be disseminated is always going to be deceptive. And I think that we can't lull ourselves into thinking that, like, let's just put it in the context, right? Internet is made by the government. The government set it up. It was military from day one, right? So that's exactly what we're dealing with. They then commercialized it and brought it to the general public. Why? Because now they have control over it. They can decide what gets disseminated and who it gets disseminated to and why. And just a side note, with 5G coming around the circle, there's going to be even greater problems of security among so-called civilians. That includes these poor white people as well, so-called white people. But I think that the information that we're going to constantly get is just always going to be, we always have to retake it with a grain of salt, so to speak. And then now, I looked at, and this is, again, disinformation. I looked at somebody like, and VGQ to this man, Thomas Sowell, and I looked at Jason Riley. These are black males that are, quote unquote, classify themselves as right-wing Republicans. And when I listened to them talk, I could see the confusion in them and how they're being racially showcased by the right wing. But to put things in perspective, like for people like these, and this is something I've been big on. I feel like we have to have a stance where we can all step back and kind of go, you know, these people are not moving the same way that we are. We have to separate ourselves from them, even though they claim they speak for us. And I think that that's one of the, to me, one of the basic things that we could do just to say, like, okay, you may have this opinion, but it's not for the benefit of the so-called community. So we have to separate from you, and we will not support you. You know what I mean? Until you come to do something that's beneficial for all of us. And it's not to say we go out and badmouth that person. We don't go to their shows and or their meetings or their interviews and throw anything at them. This is not about disrespect at all. But it's just about understanding that we are at war and you're fighting with the wrong side. Simple and plain.
I understand that, but we also have to have that understanding that there's not many of us that's backing them. They have their bills paid, and that's the reason why they're being showcased, because of the financial gain that they have received from those.
Or the biscuit.
Yes. But I agree, and man, that's why it's so wonderful that Scotty created the platform just to have these conversations, because truth be told, I've been, especially with like the Nipsey Hussle, you was talking about the Nipsey Hussle thing. I've seen where situations, what people would think are random mistakes, they get monetized, whether we're talking about situations in the neighborhood with the police, or in corporate standings when you be at work. And I could just see the government using this for any amount of people to be going back and forth over who killed them. Did the government kill him? That's something for them to manipulate. And that's all. I was just wondering if anybody else, if that crossed your mind. Does that make sense, Cujo?
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. I agree. Just like Rod said earlier, the whole aspect of it is about confusion. And that confusion, they get to deceive us and lead us the wrong way as much as possible. And they've been doing an excellent job of it up to date.
My next thing... Thank you, sir. My next thing before we head on out of here, we had a lot of issues earlier. I'm going to have to go do some saving and writing some things down so we don't have these issues anymore. Roz, the next thing I had for you that I wanted to ask you tonight was, if we was to start back the book study club, I know we would have to find a time and what have you. Would we need one for the children also? One for whatever counter racism issues we're going to deal with, and one for the counter racism for the children? And what kind of books will we read, if so?
You mean for children?
Yes. Because I personally have been starting with some of the books that I have here and just reading them to my children. I'm wondering what type of list would we put together if we did a book study club for that?
I would have to look, because you want books that are age appropriate. Because when I say age appropriate, I mean in the sense that some of these concepts are kind of presented in most of these books in a certain way. So a child of a certain age might not be actually ready for those concepts. It all depends. So I'm thinking like what age that would be. Cause like I read the ISIS papers when I was 16, some 16-year-olds aren't even ready for the ISIS papers, but I was able to comprehend it at that age. But it's not saying that all aren't, but I'm just saying that some people, just the concepts take a while. You might have to read the book more than once. It all depends on the person and how well read they are, especially. And we're not even in the world where people tend to read a lot, unless it's, you know, something on the internet, which is usually just quick and you move on to the next thing. So it's a certain type of child. And I think there's quite a few of them out there. It would just have to be what age we're trying to reach. And then we would have to really try and dig deep to find text that would be age appropriate, where it wouldn't be an issue as far as them understanding the concepts and what's being conveyed to them in those particular texts. You know what I mean?
I do. I just know you'd be having
it's a lot easier for adults, because, you know, we're all of age, and adults are just more easily malleable in regards to, like, okay, I can look up a word real quick on the, in the, online on the dictionary if I don't know what that word means. A child is not, it might not be that savvy. All those little nooks, little, you know, things that adults do that a child might not naturally be inclined to do. There's all these nuances with that. And then again, the biggest thing is the age of the children we're trying to reach more than anything else.
Well, I ask you that for a reason, but before I get into the reasoning, Cujo, do you have any, because I know you have a son, do you read any of these type of texts to your child, your son, and what would be some suggestions that you would have, if you don't mind?
Great question, too.
Say again.
No, I said that's a great question, too.
It's a difficult thing to say because I've put my son to books like Richard Wright's Black Boy, you know, but then I'll put him to something else like I have a book that's it's a pretty decent book, Children of Blood and Bone. I wouldn't call it a really counter-racist book, but it's still written by a black woman from a black woman's perspective, so it's definitely positive. Also, what I've done is give him a lesson on this book is it's a basic one that I gave him way back, and it was by, I believe it's J.A. Rogers. It's From the Beginning of Time to Present, Your History by J.A. Rogers. It's almost written like a comic book, but it has a lot of great facts and details about some of the great non-white people throughout history that he's never going to know about in school, you know, and it gives him some kind of foundation to work with to say, hey, I was never just a slave, you know. So these are the kind of books I've been kind of keeping. I really kept it light with him as far as how hard, like what Ross said, I read the ISIS papers around maybe when I was 18 or 19 or something like that. And really, before I even got into the ISIS papers, I actually got into 48 Laws of Power. And from that, I started to understand the power dynamic between myself and white people. And that just made me had to go and learn, then go into ISIS papers, then go into Nellie Fuller. And then that was my journey. Somebody else's journey is different. You feel me?
I do.
You know, I do. So that's what worked.
I think we should ponder on that and table it, ponder on it, and circle back. I know for me that would be the case. But I know that there's some books that we can probably read for young folks. I just don't think that, and depending on the text I can dig up, because I have a big library, I'll probably be able to find some. But like I said, it would just have to be a more age-appropriate thing for me just to make sure that I'm not reading it in vain and they are lost in some particular concept in the text. I think J.A. Rogers' books are really, really good for like teenagers, early teens through probably the end of high school, just because of the information. And then the way he writes it, it's accessible. He doesn't use a lot of big words and stuff. Not that he's an intelligent person, but I'm just saying he doesn't use words in a way in which I think a child would not be able to even imply meaning. It's very easy to imply meaning if you don't actually know what the word means. So I think his texts are really, really good for reaching young people. Tony Browder has some texts for young people. I know for a fact they're not that big, but they're really, really good. So there's some text there. Like I said, I think I want to table it, you know, take some time to kind of look into it and then circle back and have this discussion again.
Okay.
Yeah. I wanted to get into something too, or a couple of things before we leave, because there was a very important article that I came across after seeing Renetta Jones, my fellow Trinidadian counterpart, who is a regular on Lance Curve, and I found this beautiful article about it, and then there's a couple of videos I wanted to play. And then this is just going to center around first our history and then the solidarity of our people, okay? So this is an article from Face to Face Africa, and it's entitled, let me go and find, okay, and it's very short, so I'm just going to read it quickly. the modern day Queen of Sheba that you might not have heard of. So this is really something. Many of us only know the Queen of Sheba as the powerful and wealthy biblical and Quranic figure who visited Solomon in Jerusalem to prove him, quote unquote, prove him with cloud questions, which he answered satisfactorily, but the lineage of the real queen lives today. The modern day Queen of Sheba is little known among circles where she is not prominent, but her influence and power is felt throughout the world. Meet Imperial Majesty the Nubia Sheba, Empress of the African Royal Kingdoms, the Queen of Sheba, Queen Sheba III. Sheba III was born September 19th, 1963, to Asare Kasambu Ross. Lines descendants by her, by HRM Prince Michael and HRM Queen Mary Rire, Mary Rod VII, the daughter of the late Nubian Imperial Monarch Iris Mary Rire II in Trinidad and Tobago. She is the fourth generation of migrated Nubian Kushite. Nubian Kushites of Nubia, Sheba Sudan, North African royal ancestry. She is a descendant of the oldest matriarchal line or matriarchal throne in Africa, which originated in Kush, present-day South Sudan, and she is recognized as such by many African kingdoms throughout the continent. Queen Sheba III was enthroned in January of 2000. She is currently the vice president of the Arab African Supreme Council for Arab African Supreme Council for Africa Affairs, which is headquartered in Egypt. The council is an organization of high-level professional Arab and African business people. She also heads the African Kingdoms Federation, an organization that seeks to restore the Federation of African Kingdoms under the belief that Africans and its descendants are all one people. The Federation has a YouTube channel which spotlights her work and influence throughout the world. She has visited kingdoms in Liberia, the Ivory Coast, Ghana, and many other African countries where she was welcomed like a true African royal. The Sheba Imperial Empire and kingdoms had over 350 major kingdoms of nations and several thousand chiefdom nations throughout the African continent. They migrated from their ancestral North African region downwards in the 1800s and then outside of Africa by the mid-1900s. Some of the tribes migrated in 1889 and 1911 after over 150 villages in the Aswan Dam were flooded to form the dam in North Sudan. They settled the New Haifa, Sheba, New Nubia, Egypt, Meroe, Khartoum, and West Africa. Due to colonial activities between 1913 and 15, they further moved to Guadeloupe, Barbados, and finally settled in Trinidad and Tobago. The imperial monarch Iris Mary Ray Rod II was born in 1916, and he traveled later to the United States and Africa. Watched Her Imperial Majesty Empress Sheba eloquently explain her lineage in this interview when she visited Ghana in 2008. So I'm going to stop there. So this is a female who, and I've heard about this before, and I knew about this before, but it's incredible that this happened how it is. There were Nubian Kushite royals who were forced to migrate due to colonial circumstances in the region of the Upper Nile Valley. And as a result, they eventually found their way to the Western Hemisphere, to the Caribbean. And I had heard about this because there's a famous writer of African history named Paul Barton, who also is a descendant of Cushitic royals. And she's of that group, and she is the descendant of the original people who left, and she dates back to the first queens of Africa, because the oldest queens in Africa were Nubian Kushite women. So she's a direct genetic line to those people. And when they escaped the tyranny of colonialism in 1911 and 1889, they ended up settling in Trinidad. And now she has been enthroned since 2000 and doing everything I just read. And what she intends to do is reunite those kingdoms under the same umbrella that they were in ancient times. So all of this solidarity we're seeing with the African continent opening up, because there's a video I'm going to have you play, Jenny, that's really short. I want you to get to that because it'll help consolidate what's happening on the continent and the big impact that as this stuff comes to fruition, it can have on the rest of the planet, including a lot of us here who understand our lineage. But the video
does this
is
have
the one
anything
with,
does this have anything to do or does it tie in with the Wakanda villages?
Well, she doesn't specifically discuss Wakanda villages. What she's discussing is pretty much the the legal and political things that are happening on the continent to bring the entire African continent under one umbrella. So you're talking a united continent, not just countries individually that these white people created in the 1800s when they partitioned Africa. And she's talking about things that have already happened and things that are in motion to set a uniting of the continent. One of the major things that is starting this too is this African Free Trade Agreement, which is making Africa now the largest trading bloc on the planet. Right. 52 of 55 countries have signed this pact to make this free trade agreement where they all trade freely, their borders will be open, no visas, all this kind of stuff. And only three countries did not sign on, and that was Nigeria and two other countries for their own individual political and business reasons. Everybody else signed on for it. So this is where we're moving. And this other sister who, I'm forgetting who she is, but she's the one who first talked about the Wakanda Village. She's heading a lot of the international diaspora and continental African connections that are being made today. And this video is the one that's, it says amazing African and African diasporans need to hear this.
Got it.
It's in the thread.
Got
that's
it.
The one. Yeah. So play that real quick. It's not that long.
No, there have been other coups that were created by.
Is that the correct one? I guess that's the correct one.
Organization. No, there have been other coups that were created by just mercenaries who were running around trying to destabilize African countries, and always because the African countries would have discovered a natural resource. And they created those coups. So while the locals are fighting, thrown into a civil war, they will be siphoning that natural resource. We know the game now. We've seen them play the game. So it's not like there was no attempt to pull back. But the reality is, even now, when leaders have tried to push back on certain issues, next thing you know, there's conflict in that country. And who are they using for the conflict? Us. The people who are going to be toying on the streets, it's us, the Africans. And we are going on the streets fighting somebody else's war because we simply do not know. Let me bring it home, for example. If, let's say, a Francophone African leader decides to pull out of the pact, by the way, they also print the money, the CFA. They print the CFA for all the Francophone African countries. France no longer even use the CFA. But they print it gladly for the African countries. France is using the euro. So if a leader starts wanting to be too smart, all they have to do is stop printing the money. And next thing you know, the locals are getting their paychecks, they're going to the bank, they line up, there is no physical cash. Is that easy to destabilize Africa? Food in most of the Francophone countries, close to 50% in some countries, the food is coming from France. If you start acting like you're too smart, they simply stop sending food. And before you know it, the shelves are empty. And the locals start demonstrating. And they'll be demonstrating and blaming the president. I am not saying our African presidents don't have any blames. Nobody's without blame. No country is perfect. No leader is perfect. I get that. But what I'm saying is, in order for us to make sure when we demonstrate, when we complain, we are complaining about issues that are truly matter to us, not issues that we are being thrown into because somebody else has a different agenda. They're basically throwing a shiny object in one direction, and we run after the shiny object when the real issue is over here. So what I'm talking about is, like, Africa is like a tree. The problems of Africa, such as youth unemployment, poverty, disease, starvation, those are the leaves on a tree. They're drying up. Today, this country has the problem. Tomorrow is that country. Those are the issues. They're leaves. They're going to come and go. The branches, they're going to die, but they'll come back season after another. But until you address the issues of the root, this tree will always be a problem. For Africa, the root has to do with the Berlin Conference. We must be clear that the Berlin Conference is alive and well. A decision that was made 124 years ago remains alive and well today. In addition, after the Berlin conference, they did something just as deplorable. They set out to let the Africans believe everything African was bad and everything European was better and more desirable. That's the rule of divide and conquer. That's the legacy of colonization. Have you ever wondered why, when you try to go home at the airport, if you travel with our brothers and sisters who happen to be Caucasian, they get better treatment by our own people? I was trying to go through the airport. I won't mention which country in Africa. I called the porter 3 times. The man would come and hang around. The minute I look another way, he's gone. I later found out from one of the porters that, we are looking for the white people because they pay more. My own people are discriminating against me. Thanks to the Berlin Conference. Thanks to the legacy of colonization. Thanks to the rule of divide and conquer. Those are some of our realities. How do you address that? We must understand it. We must realize on an individual basis that we are suffering from this affliction. This affliction that is called the legacy of colonization and the legacy of slavery. Because for true healing to take place, for sustainability to take place, it has to start with the conversation with the image in the mirror. So when it's all said and done, our understanding of what is really going on in Africa, what is really making Africa end up where Africa is where we need to begin. So for today, I ask you to understand the Berlin Conference and its relevance to you today, its relevance in your family today, its relevance to your country and to your continent and to the world wherever black people are. So we got 2 issues, the legacy of slavery, the legacy of colonizations, 2 demons that we must fight, 2 afflictions that we must accept that we suffer from, and let's make every effort to defeat those demons within us in order for us to truly represent our Africa when with full understanding of the issues. So as we look for a solution, our minds are clear and our minds are in the right place. Allow me to take a moment to then take you to 1963. Our Pan-African leaders realizing that in order for Africa to move forward, Africa must speak with one voice, one continent, one country, one heart, one mind, one soul. So they met in Addis Ababa in 1963, and they created the OAU, Organization of African Unity. It was an attempt to regroup and undo the boundaries that were imposed upon us. Unfortunately, when they went to Addis Ababa, they were still divided. We had the Casablanca group who were Pan-Africanists, who says African Union now, Africa for the Africans. But unfortunately, there were only 7 of them. Ghana, Guinea, Mali, Egypt, Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. And the rest of the African countries were the nationalists. They were the Monrovia group. They said, no, let's go slow. They won. We often say, when the Pan-Africanists lost in 1963, Africa lost. 55 years later, we're still going slow. All is not lost, however. Last year, 2018, our leaders came together in Kigali. They agreed on a decision which is now called the African Continental Free Trade Area. This agreement, they are saying, we must speak with one voice. We must negotiate with one voice as a bloc, as one Africa. Because as Africa, we are a heavyweight and we belong with heavyweight boxers. We belong with the big boys. There's parity there. This is how we begin to destroy the Berlin Conference. And of the 52 heads of states who have signed on to this, we only need 22 ratifications. I'm glad to tell you today that we're sitting at 21 ratifications. We have only 1 more ratification for the African Continental Free Trade Area to become the law of the continent, and implementation is expected to begin in June of 2019. Now that's how we destroy the Berlin Conference. In addition, They also signed in March of last year the protocols for the free movement of people, where they are saying unanimously the African heads of states, the children of Africa must live and work wherever they choose. That too is in the process of being ratified. Over 30 heads of states have signed, and I believe we are sitting at about 3 or 4 ratifications. Already, regionally, the leaders are loosening the requirements to get in into their countries. A lot of countries now are visa on arrival. There's a lot of good news coming out of your Africa. And I'm here to share with you that we must be part of that change. We must be part of that vibrancy that is Africa. You see, everybody else around the world is strategizing on how to take advantage of this new Africa whose doors are swinging wide open. The only people who are not strategizing to move into your Africa and claim what is rightfully yours are us, black people. Why can't we be like the rest of the other diaspora in this world? Ask for the voices of Indian diaspora loud and clear, Chinese diaspora loud and clear, Irish diaspora loud and clear, Mexicans, Jews. But when you ask for the voices of the black people, you might as well go to the graveyard. We are missing in action. This is where we are not only failing ourselves, our children, our grandchildren, and generations to come. We have got to change this. We have got to come together just like other ethnic groups and speak with one voice. We must realize that our sheer survival depends on us coming together and speaking with one voice. As, like I would like to say, the beautiful, intelligent, sophisticated, highly adaptable, and totally indestructible Mother Africa's children. You see, we as Africans, as the origin of humanity, the continent, the inheritors of the continent with everything and anything the world needs, we have every reason to stand on top of the highest mountain and proclaim to the world who we are, the indestructible children of Africa. Mother Africa is calling. I have no doubt in my mind that all of you, after having had a serious conversation with the image in the mirror, you are going to come together, and with a united voice and in a resounding way, you shall let the world know that the children of Africa are going home. Let's sing the best melody the world has ever heard as we come together, not as 55 African countries, not as 1.27 billion Africans on the continent, not as 400 million blacks around the globe, but as children of one Mother Africa, singing in unison that beautiful melody as we waltz our way across the Atlantic back home to Africa.
The cost of health care is high.
That right there, Roz.
Mm-hmm.
That goes for the same thing that she said need to go on here. Just come to an agreement that we could trade and be respectful to one another. Let that do the talking. But
absolutely. Absolutely, and go ahead. What are you going to say?
I say, but some refuse.
That's going to be the downfall of us, are those who refuse, especially when they have no logical reason to refuse. And that's the I think the severe mental illness of ideological tribalism. And it's not by accident. It really isn't. But it's just so sad when I see it. And it rears its head, and you look at a person and they're going off and they have their own thoughts and ideas, which is fine. But it clouds their vision so much that they completely miss everything else outside of their tunnel vision view of the subject at hand, rather than seeing that there's a bigger picture that's beyond whatever ideology you are pigeonholed into, holding to your breast so intensely. And it's really sad. And there was actually one last clip that I had, and that one is actually super short. It's the one that says Black Solidarity before the ADOS movement. I think it's less than 5 minutes.
Like, I got it.
3 minutes. Play that. Play that real quick. I think it's something we need to hear.
Begin to see America as really an ugly, as a whole thing of it as an ugly scene. After the assassination of President Kennedy in 63, and then particularly King in 68, and then Bobby Kennedy, you know, things began to go down. I really saw an ugly scene, but there was a rapid and immediate upsurge of something that held us together. And you know what that was? Blackness, Africanness. Tikis began to be worn, dashikis began to be worn, right on was said, brother, everybody was a brother, everybody was an African, everybody was, was a sister. We came together, you know, afros were being worn, and there was a heavy wave of that. And that hasn't left me at all, a heavy wave of that kind of blackness and black solidarity. And it looked like everywhere you went, somebody was trying to see who could be the blackest and whatever, you know, who cared where it was. And on somebody getting up on a box making a speech. And somebody was, a brother was always trying to show he was blacker than somebody else. And that, and this was the thing that supported. I remember my pastor saying, it would have been really, it would have been, he made this statement, Griffin made this statement, said, you know, I really would love to have seen which way King would have gone had he not been killed and had to live through that Africanness that we went through in 68. And 69 and 70 and 71. Tell Nixon came in, you know, because we went through a heavy wave of African Swahili, the language. Then we begin to name our children African names. All of these and other things begin to upsurge and come into, you know, into focus. So just as the country went down, there was that inner voice of saying, you know, and fellow Stokely and Rap Brown and the Panthers, and these were they who kept us up as well, you know. Panther Party and others, NAA and all the rest. But, you know, there was that deep wave of blackness.
And I think a lot of parents, you know, just instilled that blackness into their children during that time. I know with us, we were just so, so black. You know, everything was just so, so black. Black power, you know, our children just knew it backwards and forward. And like in our home, Wednesday night?
Friday.
Every Friday, my husband gave our children an assignment. They had to learn something about Africa and report on it. And it paid off. It really did. It paid off, you know. And today they really appreciate it. You don't have to go around wearing it on your collar, but it comes out. And you know who you are. You're not ashamed of your identity. And you know who you are, you know. So it really pays off to know who you are and express it whenever it's necessary, you know. Or just wear it proudly, you know. Whoever race you are, you know. Lots of times when I get ready to talk about blackness, I see the expression on black students' faces as if to say, oh, you're going to hurt somebody's feelings. You know, you can't talk about that because you're going to hurt my friend's feeling. And then I have to say, look, you all have changed these expressions on your faces. I said, what I'm about to say or what I'm going to say is not going to hurt such and such a person. You know, he needs to know and you need to know and stop feeling protective of this person. You know, I said, I'm not going to say anything bad. I'm not throwing off on him. I'm trying to teach everybody, you know, so you don't need to feel that way. You know, and it's like you're walking on eggs, you know, but I dismiss that. Don't do that. Don't do that. You know,
that thought, whites, the haves, blacks, the have-nots, whites, the superior, blacks, the inferior. Don't talk about anything but black, because that's inferior, and we're going to be embarrassed. We've never heard anything great about ourselves. You know, this is the implication thereof. Yeah. You never heard anything great. We're not in the textbooks. It's being withheld from us on every hand, where we go, on TV. We get a distorted version of it on TV. The media misrepresents us. So, you know, we can't be but so much. We haven't excelled. You see, this is a part of the white racist bag, I should say. You know, this is where this thought, this concept has its roots. Now, if we're in textbooks, if we're on TV, You know, see education and opportunity. Howard University on TV, Spelman, often, you know, and other stuff on that Shaw, Virginia Union, and other black colleges, and also, well, mainly in textbooks, you know, where you can grab that mind early, you know. But when you are always, when you've always been told that you've come from nothing, you know, and even if you haven't been told that, if it's acted out the way it's acted out in society, you begin to feel subservient. You know, you begin to feel inferior.
It's propaganda.
Now, what was the difference between the time period they were talking about and today?
Crack.
What's the difference? Do you know?
One of them was crack. That's a big.
It was one. There was no internet.
That is a.
There was no internet. They knew who they were. They taught their children who they were. They lived in some form of solidarity. Their women didn't wear weaves. They wore afros, and everybody was trying to out black or out African everybody. Why did they know who they were? But today, everybody wants to be everything but African. Is this really the age of information, or is this the age of disinformation? The age of the most incredible codified COINTELPRO program known to man. And it's the reprogramming of the psychosocial behavior and education of black people via electronic mind control, because you have to remember the internet is a world. That's why I like that show, American Gods. They depicted the internet as a world. White people literally created an entire world where they are the gods of that world. And we have been immersed in it without our full permission. It was presented to us beneficently. We saw all the benefits of it in the very beginning of the internet. And then they flipped the switch and weaponized it. And now you have the most unorganized, full of dissension, full of self-hatred, people who don't know who they are. They want to be anything but African. And some of them have the most vehement hatred for anything African. What was the difference between the 60s and 2019? They didn't have access to instantaneous mass disinformation. They didn't live in a world where people are so attached to their electronic devices, they don't even know what simple empathy looks like, because they don't have human contact anymore. And they're trapped in their children sit in the bedroom all summer and gain weight playing video games on the internet rather than going outside and riding a bike and playing, you know, stickball or running bases or all the little games we used to play, Skelly, all that stuff. They don't do that anymore. So they don't even know about simple empathy, how to look you in the eye when you have a conversation, how to shake your hand like a man. They got these limp, feminine handshakes. You know, dudes can't look you in the eye. They don't know how to put a tie on. They don't have simple, basic human skills. But yet they know that they hate anything African and that they're not African. But their grandparents wonder what Martin Luther King would have been like if he lived to see and experience that resurge of African identity and being expressed overtly and covertly in every circle. You look at how many black women wear weaves today. Nobody wore weaves back then, and they knew who they were. Nobody put formaldehyde Hindu hair on their heads. And if you study weaves, you'll find out that it has formaldehyde in it. And it's one of the most toxic things you can have on your scalp, absorbing into your brain and into your body, toxifying your system. It's a fact that our relaxers cause fibroids in females. So, the sister Mumbi, Dr. Mumbi Seraki, used to have fibroids. And as soon as she stopped putting the toxic lye in her hair to relax it, the fibroids disappeared instantly. So she was perfect personal proof of that, but they scientifically proved that. What's the difference between the American African woman in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s versus the African American woman of today? They didn't twerk back then. They didn't wear weaves back then. Everybody was brother and sister back then. Man, woman, and child was the family structure back then. We've been screwed horribly, and we're completely blind. It's almost like somebody hit you with a roofie and they sodomized you and you roofied out. So you have no idea that of what's being done to you. You just wake up the next day and know that you're in severe pain and bleeding and don't know what the hell happened to you. That's us. Just listening to that clip and comparing that yesterday to today and just thinking about what's the difference, what's missing. What was missing back then, or better yet, what was there back then? What have we acquired that made us better and more advanced and in a position where we could make better decisions to try and end the system? But we think that we're the greatest, most technologically advanced people. But socially, we've regressed to the point where from the 60s and 70s to now, we've done a complete 180 as a people. Do you think Nipsey Hussle would have got shot, or Nipsey Hussle type of person would have been shot back then by another black person? Do you think that was a likely outcome? Come on now. There's a major screwing that's been done here. And it's no different than buck breaking, but this is on a massive scale psychologically. And it's not just the black man. But you see it with the black men, because we wear dresses, some of us, and think that's cute, and clogs. It's freaking crazy when I think about it. Go ahead, Jenna. Go ahead.
You addressed a lot of things. And there are a list of reasons. We won't get into those tonight, but that has sparked a whole nother conversation. What's most important? Learning from the mistakes that we've made in the past, and being able to foresee these same steps that are coming to us right now and trying to solve those problems. But we have went past time, even though we did start late. If you go ahead with your finishing thoughts and hit us with the prayer rise.
No problem. Thanks to everyone for spending your Tuesday night with us. I greatly appreciate it. I would say my final thoughts are this. Another thing that we need to look to the past for is, who were we back then? Look at how close we were. We weren't perfect, but we were closer. I know for a fact the difference between pre-crack Brooklyn, New York, and post-crack Brooklyn, New York. And pre-crack Brooklyn, New York was a really nice place. Things happened, but everybody knew everyone. Your neighbor said good morning. You didn't have a chance of the neighbor's child picking you up. None of that was really happening like that. You had your one-off incidents here and there, but it wasn't crazy like that. So, to me, when we look to the past too, look at the things that kept us in the state of solidarity and compare the past to today and ask yourself surrounding certain circumstances, especially the positive circumstances that our people found themselves in. What's the difference between then and now? And try and just make comparative deductions on why we are the way we are today, and how it compares to how we used to be when you hear things like what was just discussed. It really gives you a pause for thought on, was getting all of this technology a real improvement, or have we been really duped? We've been duped. But the vast majority of us do not have discussions like this to even think about something like that or care to, because they're getting the dopamine rush. But it gets you addicted to hating yourself. And then you just play a game of confirmation bias and have, you know, fiery conversations with somebody who doesn't share the same ideology as you. That's what we've been reduced to while they're about to collapse the economy. So with that, we're going to end the show tonight. I just really like to thank everyone for being with us, spending your Tuesday evening. I greatly appreciate your time and your energy. We hope to see you next week, Tuesday. Please stay safe. Stay out of the hands of slave catchers. Do what you can to keep yourself safe. And we'll say the prayer and close out. Creator, we ask that you help us to remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us to remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time that we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time to replace white supremacy with justice immediately and end prison industrial complex and human trafficking. I am in the love of the all, and all love is in me. I am a part of the all, and the all is a part of me. I am one with the all, and the all is one with me. I can succeed as a part of the all and fail as an individual. I can be all that I wish in the all, as long as my wish is to stay in the all. I am never alone. The all is, I am. The all can, I can. The all does, I do. Keep in mind the African proverb. If there are no enemies within, enemies without can do little harm. Once again, thank you for spending your Tuesday night with us. Again, we'll create a willing to see you next week, Tuesday. Please stay safe out of the hands of slave catchers, and may you learn something new each day that passes between now and next Tuesday when we speak to you next. One love, good night, and peace and love to you all.
Peace and love. Good night.
Night.
Call recording off.
Peace.
Peace, Cujo. Peace.